Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Tommy Toon. Reviews include Second Stage's production of Smart People, A Bronx Tale, the musical at Paper Mill Playhouse, the new group's production of Buried Child, Playhouse Creatures Theatre Company's production of Tennessee Williams 1982, Twelfth Night at the Skirball Center, and Fantasia at NJ Pack. Please stay tuned.
When he heard the jazz band playing, he was happy as a lark. To each measure he kept swaying, and he stayed till after dark. Then back to the land he knew, thrill through and through, he sailed on in the air. Called all the other birds, and in these words started gurgling then and there. I'm a little jazz bird, and I'm telling
you. Hello, and welcome to Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway for Sunday, February 21st, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many of the places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Morning, Michael.
Morning.
With us this morning, we have a Broadway legend. Tommy Toon is with us, 10-time Tony Award winner. 10 times, I can't even imagine. Tommy, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
I tell you, you know, where does one start when we interview you? But we want to make sure that we get out there right now that the Encore's Lady Be Good cast recording is out, and this is one thing that should be in everybody's collection. Tell us about your experience in doing Lady Be Good.
It was a dream job. It was absolutely wonderful. I had a wonderful number in the first act, Fascinating Rhythm, and a wonderful number in the second act, Little Jazz Bird. And I came in for no reason, and I did them, and I went off, and it just worked great. It was there was in the original production, which was this, you know, Lady Be Good was the Gershwin's very first Broadway musical. Mm-hmm. George Gershwin had just done Rhapsody in Blue, released it, and critics did not know what to make of it. It was all, they didn't know, well, is it classical, is it jazz, what is it? And then they wrote this first score for Lady Be Good. And the show originally starred Fred and Adele Astaire. But there was this one character, and they called him, I don't know what they called him in the script, but it was played by a vaudevillian named Ukulele Ike, and he just wandered in and did Fascinating Rhythm and did the same thing in the second act with Little Jazz Bird. So it was really up for grabs how we wanted to do it, and that's why they thought of me, because I'm so difficult to cast. So this could be anything, so, oh, get Tommy Toon. So the first act number turned into a big tap number that Randy Skinner did, and we have it all on the recording. You can hear, well, most of, and you can hear the tapping. We did a lot of tapping on the recording for that number. The second number, Lady Be Good, I tapped in, but we didn't include that in the recording. But the music for this show was so sweet and so dear and so innocent, and yet it had the hints of all of the stuff to come, and it had even hints of how the Rhapsody in Blue had spilled over into his Broadway brain. Mm. So it was a wonderful discovery of all this music, and all the orchestrations had to be reconstructed because they had disappeared. So we had a few little sketches here and there, and Rob Fisher did an incredible job putting together. Every night I would stand as close to the stage as possible and listen to the overture. It's so wonderful. Very, very pure.
So, well, also, it's interesting that you were behind a panel when we first saw you, and it was revealed, and there you were standing there. And, of course, the house went crazy because it's been so long since we've seen you on a New York stage, be it as a performer or even a director choreographer. So it must really, really feel good being behind a panel like that and knowing when that panel is revealed, the house is going to go crazy.
Well, you don't know that till it happens. I didn't know what to do.
Really?
I didn't know what to do because I had one little line, and then suddenly I was doing this number, and they just kept clapping. I was better the second performance. Did you see the first performance?
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, these two
you
guys.
You were fine. You were fine.
I was fine. I was overwhelmed.
We had Randy Skinner on our podcast around that time and talked a lot about it, and he was so thrilled to have you. And we mentioned that for those who don't recognize the name Ukulele Ike, that he's Jiminy Cricket, the voice of Jiminy Cricket.
I didn't even know that. That he's the voice of Jiminy Cricket?
Yes, yes.
Huh? Oh, my gosh, I didn't know that at all, because I always felt that Jiminy Cricket was Fred Astaire, because he was so fleet-footed, and I always liken it. This is so interesting. I always liken Fred Astaire and Jiminy Cricket, because he just, you know, he was so evanescent.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Amazing. Oh, I'm going to learn something every day.
So Lady Be Good ran for 7 performances and encores just about a year ago, February 4th to 8th in 2015. And you had just mentioned about the tapping being on the cast recording. Is the cast recording live or a combination of the shows?
We went into a studio and it was meticulously done. They didn't grab it from the stage during the performance. We did every piece and so sometimes several takes to get it right. It's meticulous.
Now, go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I was just going to say it's interesting because we were discussing last week that there was reports that a sound system has been put in at City Center a year or two ago.
Yeah, when they did the renovation.
Yeah, and that they would be able to make high quality live recordings of the encore shows. That doesn't mean they're going to find funding for them. But the Pipe Dream that was released is a live recording. But now we're hearing of at least 2 studio recordings, yours, and also A New Brain has just come out.
Oh, good. Okay.
So,
I like that show.
Yeah, yeah. But it's either way, it's so wonderful to have these preserved. It really is.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
and the orchestra for the show was so great in the studio. They're just the top musicians on Broadway, and they were so into it. And it was a big orchestra, and oh my God, the concentration was thrilling, thrilling. We all just wanted to get it down because. You know, this becomes history.
Hmm. All right. Now, for those of us who have seen you since Baker Street on stage, the question becomes, many of us did not see you in EFX in Las Vegas. I want to know if the Las Vegas audiences were substantially different from New York. Did you have a wonderful time doing it, et cetera?
Oh, my gosh. This was a huge assignment. I was supposed to be in the show for 3 months, and it stretched on to 2 years. And I loved it, I have to tell you, because in Vegas, you do 10 shows a week. Broadway, you do 8. Vegas, you do 10 shows a week. But the plus is you do 2 shows a night. 2 shows a night with a little break in between. But then you have a complete weekend, which I had never had for as long as I'd been in show business.
Yeah.
2 days off. One day, of course, I just stayed in bed the whole day recovering from the 10 performances. And then I actually had 1 day off where I could do like one thing, go out and be like a real person. And it was thrilling. That part was so exciting. And I love to work hard. I really love to work hard. My father raised us that, my sisters and I, that if we weren't dog tired at the end of the day when we put our head on a pillow, we had cheated. Yeah. So I have a very strong work ethic, and I really, really like to work. And so Vegas fulfilled that for sure. The show itself was a marathon. I was hardly, the only time I was off the stage was changing, and I think I had 10 changes. Mm. And they were all were fast changes, and I played four different characters. Is this what you want to hear?
Yes, of course. However, I do want to hear if the audiences seemed very different to you in Las Vegas.
Well, they were, yeah, because everybody's a tourist. There's mm-hmm. there's no community to the. They came from here and there and there and there and across the ocean. So there was no community that you were playing to. Like Mike, I've done a lot of touring. Carol Channing taught me very early on in my career that if I really was serious about having a life in the theater, I had to tour my shows to the capitals of the world.
Does anybody ever quote Carol Channing without using her voice? Anyway, go on.
Well, you can't because it doesn't work. She is her own thing.
Right.
That's you funny. Have to.
Because last night I was talking with Leroy Reams.
Oh, yeah. Well, he does a great Carol.
Anyway, go on. We interrupted you.
That's okay. I'm trying to remember the four characters. I started. It was Barnum and Merlin and... Who's the guy that wrote The Time Machine?
H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells and one more character. I can't remember who it is. And then, of course, myself. Mm-hmm. And so I inherited this show from Michael Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michael Crawford got injured and David Cassidy took over the show. And then after David Cassidy, I came. And each time the show changed. But the major effects sequences had to stay the same because they were mechanical and very expensive and computerized and all. So it was an incredible experience. Of course, I put dancing in the show, and that was my what made it different from the other guys. And I don't know, it was a big success. They kept extending my contract, so I just stayed. I got into the swing of it, and after the first 3 months, I didn't live in the hotel anymore. I found a place out on a mountain outside of Las Vegas. There's this mountain called Mount Charleston, mm-hmm. and it's about a 45-minute commute, but I was figuring, you know, from uptown, Upper East Side to Broadway, sometimes it takes 45 minutes, too. Mm-hmm. So they thought I was crazy that I wasn't living in Vegas. But that was my solace to escape all the slot machines and all the cigarette smoke and get up to the mountain and breathe fresh air. And I think it was what kept my health intact.
Tommy, mm-hmm. I have to ask you, when you were living yeah. in the hotel, did you have any thoughts about Grand Hotel?
No, I never did. Yeah, the MGM Grand Hotel. Well, there is a revolving door that never stops. You know, the hotel never closes.
Looking around for a Kringle line.
Yeah, looking around for a Kringle line, yeah.
Grand Hotel is one of our favorites.
But I did live in Grand Diggs in the hotel. It was like this huge apartment that was a duplex, and it had an elevator with a spiral staircase surrounding the elevator, so I could either ride the elevator or climb the stairs. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a kitchen, a huge dining room, and, you know, it was very, very grand, but it was still in the hotel, and, you know, yeah, I just needed to get off the strip.
Oh, yeah. No, we understand that. So let's reflect back for a little while, just for a few minutes on Grand Hotel and that wonderful project that you brought to Broadway. So,
oh, well, I guess people always ask me what's my favorite, you know, what's my favorite show that I did, and I always say the next one. But right uh-huh. now I'm thinking of Grand Hotel strongly because later this year I'm going to Japan and do an all Asian version of it.
Oh, really?
Version of it, yes. I'm very excited about it because I haven't touched it because I don't really do revivals.
Mm-hmm.
This will be the first revival I think I've ever done. So I don't quite know how to approach it because, of course, they want it like it was. So mm-hmm. I have to go and see what I did way back then. But I was proud of that show. It had a difficult birth, but all my shows have difficult births. but that one came out really well.
Yes, certainly did. I literally saw it 17 times.
And that's a magic number.
In fact, the other day we were talking about the greatest production numbers in the history of Broadway, and I realized two came from that show, of course, and that's Who Couldn't Dance With You and We'll Take a Glass Together. Two astonishing production numbers, and I would say of the top 10, you'd have to have at least two from that show, so that's pretty good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I love being included with numbers like Hello, Dolly. I'm sure that's on the list.
It is on the list, in fact.
Oh, yeah. It's my favorite, Coward Champion. Wow, what a great show that was.
And there again, we did finally get a cast album. If only it had been sooner.
Oh, I know. We had a lot of trouble getting that cast album on. I guess we ran out of money.
So you also have Taps, Tunes, and Tall Tales coming up that you've been doing for a little while, and you have
doing that all over the country. I just finished. I just finished 2 weeks in Palm Beach at the Colony Hotel in the Royal Room, and Cheetah had her little accident, and which she'll be fine because she's rebooked in the Carlisle. So I went in directly from Palm Beach and just slid right into the Carlisle for 2 weeks, replacing Cheetah. She'll be back in April, so that was a nice run for a cabaret kind of show.
Yeah.
Because usually it's a week or maybe a night here and a night there, and to do it for 4 weeks in a row was felt like I was back on Broadway.
Fans in Arizona, in New York, in Pennsylvania, and in Texas are going to get to see you over the next couple of months. And now we hear that maybe you'll be spotted in Japan as well. So
yeah, I won't be doing that show, but I'll be there. I think I have a couple of gigs coming up in Pennsylvania soon.
Yeah, you have May 2nd in Pittsburgh. At the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust coming up in May 2nd. So
well, the thing about you, of course, is that you're very hard to miss.
Yes, I stick out in a crowd.
So tell us about the Taps, Tunes, and Tall Tales. What can we expect to see when we come down to see that?
Well, it's an arc of my career, but it's not linear. I hopscotch through the show. I really don't do hits from. I do mostly tunes from Broadway that make sense to my life. But I do other things, too. I do a Carole King number. I do a number. Well, it's a Green Day number. But it's from American Idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Wake Me Up When September Ends. I love that song. A lot of Gershwin. And it just arcs my career. I reenact certain things, like my first audition, which I remember distinctly, including the dance steps. And the song that I sang, the 8 bars of the song, because that's all they gave you at that time. 8 bars, no more, no less.
So it is coming up. We'll have links to both Lady Be Good and Taps, Tunes, and Tall Tales on our show page as well. Tommy, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and sharing your stories with us.
My pleasure. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so some of the smartest people I know are on this podcast right now, and the three of us got a chance to see smart people at Second Stage. So, Peter, why don't you get us started on that?
Well, this is by Lydia Diamond, who had a play that made it to Broadway a few years ago called Stickfly. And the easy thing to say about this play is that it takes her 2.5 hours to say what Jeff Marks and Bobby Lopez did in 5 minutes, which is that everyone's a little bit racist. That's what the play's really about. And we're dealing with four people: an African-American actress who isn't having much luck getting work, an African-American doctor who's doing quite well, a white man who is doing a lot of research on race relations and what makes people racist, and a another academic who's Asian American. So you do have the three different walks of life here represented, and it is very effective to have two black people, one who is successful by society standards and not successful by society standards. So you do have those two extremes. So for the longest time, all these people do is deal with matters of race, I have to say. They do get emotionally involved, sexually involved from time to time. And nothing really happens that's terribly unexpected for a while. What does happen eventually is that we do find out that the white man really does believe way down deep, or even to the surface, that white people are superior. And there's a very effective ending to the play when he realizes that, something has just happened. Something just broke, so to speak, that makes him think about it in a very different way. One of the things I didn't like about the play is that the Asian American lady was portrayed as the dragon lady, the cliche that we have seen so many times. There's a scene where she's in a store and makes demands to which she's not entitled, and she harasses the clerk, she even harasses a person behind her. But she is going to get her way, and that's all there is to it. And I think that's kind of racist in its own way, to show this famous dragon lady cliche. I couldn't help noticing that for all the talk about, we're all supposed to be equal and we're all supposed to have all that stuff, that at the end, the actor playing the white man got the last bow. I found that very interesting. So, frankly, I found that more interesting than anything else in the play, because it never really held me to the point where it wanted to hold me. It was just too long and making the same statements over and over again, and I felt I was ahead of it very much of the way, though I wasn't prepared for the ending, which as I say is very effective. So not a bad play, but not a great one either.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, I would largely agree. Although I felt that a lot of the dialogue was very smart and witty, so that kept my interest, even though yes, I did feel like the same points kept being made over and over again. It kind of felt like a lot of observations about race spoken by the various characters from their various perspectives, rather than more of a play. But I did enjoy a lot of the actual dialogue. This is by Lydia Diamond, who wrote Stick Fly, for those of us who saw that, and it's directed by Kenny Leon. And we should mention, it's quite possible, Peter, that the reason that the white man got the last bow is that the white man is the biggest TV star. It's Joshua Jackson, who is very famous from Dawson's Creek, although that was quite a while ago now, wasn't it? But
yeah,
I'm sorry, he's also, you know how I am with TV, he's also on The Affair. So he's currently on TV as well. And I thought all four of them were excellent. Marshala Ali as the African-American doctor, and Sun as the dragon lady, or the tiger mom, although I guess she's not a mom, that Peter mentioned. And Tessa Thompson, I thought she was quite delightful as the black actress who's trying to just trying to establish herself. And that was very interesting to me, in particular because of several things she said about and things that were happening to her in terms of whether she would be colorblind cast in things, or whether she would be asked to play very stereotypical roles. So that I found that all very interesting. And I would say that it did hold my interest for the entire thing, even though I agree that it could have been shorter, and it could have had more of a spine to it.
Yeah, shorter. I felt that many of the topics that they kept on hitting were repetitive.
Right.
And they made their point, but they kept on hitting it over and over. And I don't think did either of you mention that Kenny Leon directed it?
Yeah. I did. Yeah,
you did. So it's interesting that Kenny is doing a project at Second Stage that it seems like it seemed to me like this Kenny Leon should be doing bigger things than this, shouldn't he?
Well, and we all see people work here, there, and everywhere. If the project is good enough, that should be the
dream. Absolutely, but I didn't think that this was up to, Kenny Leon's snuff.
Sure, gotcha. On the other hand, you know, if this play spoke to him, that's fine. I like it when I see people who are top-notch people working in less than Broadway circumstances. Certainly, Second Stage is one of our most acclaimed theaters.
Joe Mantello does a lot of that.
Yeah, my thought was that not so much Second Stage was the problem as much as I thought that he would attach himself to better projects than this.
Well, no, different things speak to different people, yeah. And it's entirely possible that he had an experience that one of the people in the play did, and that was enough. Sometimes things like that are enough to get people to sign on to things. So we have no idea what goes through his head. So,
he's going to be doing Hairspray on TV. So
yes, he is.
Yeah, that's true.
But I did think you may disagree. I did find a lot of the actual dialogue very interesting and witty, and. And I think that also that the way the characters wound up having dealings with each other was quite clever. Although it also somewhat confusing at some points. I think that was something that the playwright gave a lot of thought to, and I liked it. I did.
I hope that we get past this. Seemingly new phase of people, characters on stage talking on a cell phone to have expository information to the audience about what's going on in their life.
God bless the cell phone for playwrights because it's wonderful because now nobody has to say hello. Oh, Charles, hi, how are you? They look and they see that on the phone that it says Charles, and so they can just start right in. So I like the cell phone as an innovation because it does save us about three or four words of exposition. So,
they got to that scene of the dinner party, it was starting to remind me of quite a bit of Disgraced. But it wasn't quite the same, but there was some similar content there, I think.
That's true. All right, so that's playing up at Second Stage. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, and check it out if you're interested in smart people. Peter and I got a chance to get out to the Paper Mill Playhouse last Sunday for the opening of A Bronx Tale, the musical. And so, Peter, why don't you give us a rundown of that?
Well, what occurred to me was that Michael Corleone needed three movies to learn what Calogero discovers in one musical. Calogero is the oddly named hero, and it actually is the actual name of Charles Palmentieri, who did do this one-man show years ago called A Bronx Tale, which led to the movie A Bronx Tale, and now has led to the musical A Bronx Tale, for which he's written the book and for which Alan Menken has composed the music and Glenn Slater has done the lyrics. So far, so good. This is the story of a young man growing up in the Bronx, and indeed his father's a bus driver, and the father is content to be a bus driver, and this is his life, and he knows it. However, in the Bronx, there's certainly Sonny, who seems to be the big gambler, outside the law type of guy, and it's very hard for young Calogero to not be impressed by the man's wealth, the man's power, and even the point where he witnesses him killing someone. Now, this is his chance to say the right thing, the truth, or to lie. And when the police ask him, and he does not turn in Sonny, because, as he says, you learn in this neighborhood very quickly the worst thing you can do is be a rat. So his father sees what happens and says to him, you've done a very Good Thing for a Bad Man. And that's a very powerful line, because we do see that the father is very much aware that this is a bad man, and he wants his son to know it. And this is the conflict, whether or not the kid is going to be seduced by this man who suddenly takes him under his wing, because, of course, he owes him something. And he likes having the kid around. I was also intrigued, as I was in Sweet Smell of Success, that he takes the liberty of saying, no, that's not your name anymore. We're going to call you C from now on. Just in Sweet Smell of Success, when J.J. Renames Sidney Falco. So it's changing somebody's name is really a powerful thing, you know, and he takes the liberty of doing that. And C does not complain at all, because he is this glamorous man. So that's the conflict. It's a good show. It's not a great show. It's a good one. I like when Alan Menken gets the chance to write for adults. And the score doesn't sound anything, of course, like The Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast, and it's not supposed to. I think it's a good score. Everything about it is good. It's good. It never transcends good, though. It never gets to be great in any way, shape, or form. It's fine. It begins. It continues. It ends. And you go home, and that's the end of it. So I don't know if this will move to Broadway. It's a good-looking production. Beowulf Borat certainly did a nice job with a unit set that doesn't come across as unity as unity as so many others. Competent work from everybody involved. Everyone can hold his head up high. But I have a feeling if you want to see A Bronx Tale, you better get to Millburn.
So
that's interesting, because I'm hearing the opposite.
Oh, good.
You know, but who knows? I mean,
I'd love to be wrong on this. I'd love to see, you know, I mean, I always wish that properties have as much success as possible. I don't need people to agree with me. But so your word of mouth is good from you, huh?
Yeah. And I also heard that, and, you know, I don't double check these things, but I heard that the run at Paper Mill was completely sold out.
Really? Good, good, good. It's wonderful what Mark Hobie has achieved out there. It's really something. And, you know, to be able to get these tryouts, and there's going to be another one next year, too, because The Bodyguard is coming into Pittsville as well. So it's really impressive what this man has been able to do in getting these shows that may move on, as Newsies did, or may not move on, as Hunchback Never After didn't. But it's very impressive that he's building something out there where people are getting used to seeing a new musical or two and saying, okay, let's see what's happening here. That didn't happen as much during the previous administration. Not as much.
Since you mentioned The Bodyguard, I haven't checked it out, but someone told me, I guess that's going to be part of a national tour.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
They do that a lot.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So.
And I'm not sure where it falls in the order, you know, on the itinerary of the tour. But so that'll be the opportunity for people in New York to see The Bodyguard, in case that never gets to Broadway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So back to A Bronx Tale. We're looking at a co-direction here. Peter, did you mention that the co-directors were Jerry Zaks and Robert De Niro?
No, that's a good point. I should have certainly mentioned that. And the show moves very well. How much one had to do and one didn't, of course, is up for grabs. You know, we can assume that De Niro was there because of the history with the project, but that Jerry Zaks was there just in case, and saying, Bob, how about this? You know, I mean, yeah, you know, who knows? You know, we're not we haven't been flies on the wall. One thing I didn't talk about was the performances, and Jason Gauthier, I think, is good as C. Sonny, Nick Cordero, of course, there's an irony here because Nick Cordero was in Bullets Over Broadway on Broadway, and Charles Palminteri played the role in the original Woody Allen movie. He's very good. However, I want to really point out that there's a nice kid named Joshua Cawley, and kid actors could really be pretty saccharine and problematic, but this kid is really quite wonderful. And he had a song in the first act that really cemented it. You could feel that the audience was really responding midway when he really let go and really soared in the song. And at the end, they really gave him a tremendous amount of applause, which he earned. So, so he's a very effective boy. And that's one of these situations where when he disappears, you know, because now the adult C is going to take over, you feel bad that you're not going to see him again till the curtain call, because it's that good a performance. So, he's one of the best things in the show, and I wish he could stay around longer, but I understand the needs of the musical as well.
Absolutely. So it's as Peter said, there's a lot of good that's happening in the show. There's a somewhat keep in my mind kept on reflecting back to a little bit of a Jersey Boys feel with the
The
guy standing underneath the lamp and singing four-part harmonies. And
it's impossible not to think of Jersey Boys.
Yeah,
it really is. And
since they also have some Jersey Boys alums in the cast as well.
Yes, that too. Yes. That said, Jersey Boys is a liability to this show because Jersey Boys is such an extraordinary musical. When the comparisons are made, it just doesn't stack up as well. Though I do know one critic whom I respect tremendously who felt exactly the opposite. He thought it was superior to Jersey Boys, which supports what Michael was saying about how the word of mouth he's heard is really, really good. So.
Now, what did you, just briefly, what did you both feel? I have not seen the musical, but I, as I mentioned before we started recording, I have problems with the source material in terms of the what I felt was like the glorification of crime and violence and, you know, mobsterism. Did that come across or not?
Oh, there's definitely a day of reckoning, to say the least. And the musical is squarely on the side of law and order.
Okay.
And squarely. And there's no doubt about that. And because the father, played by Richard H. Blake, a fine performance, says it's the working man who's the real hero. He's the one who has to get up in the morning, and he's the one who has to be at a certain place at a certain time. He makes a lot of good points there, that it's harder to be a working man, and as a result, the working man deserves far more credit than the person who lives outside the law. The show gets very, very serious towards the end. Very, very serious. Mm. And in a way, you're not prepared for it, because it seems like at the beginning with the doo-wop music and all that, that there's going to be a good time, that this is going to be a nice nostalgic look at the way things were in 1960. But it gets a little more serious than that. Also, we should point out there's racial issues to this one too, because C falls in love with a black girl, and that's a problem. One of the most effective things for me was the first act began with guys under the lamppost doing doo-wop music a cappella. Fine. The second act begins the exact same way, but it's black people doing it. And what's so wonderful is that the point is made that these people have more in common than they think they have. You know, that here they are doing the exact same things, and they all believe that they're so different and they shouldn't deal with each other. And yet, music, again, brings people together. The arts bring people together. So I think that's a very effective opening of the second act as we reflect back to what we first saw in the first act.
Yeah, I felt that this was a very large cast. I don't know. Was it a large cast in your mind, Peter, or did?
It did seem a little more populated than so many of the musicals we do see. So I think there may be one or two more out there. And the stage did not look empty. Let's say that. So
yeah, I was just thinking about it from a standpoint of moving into Broadway. I don't know how they would support that large of a cast, although maybe it's just in my imagination it was larger than normal. I didn't count it. For your question about the bodyguard, Michael, bodyguard seems like it's the paper mill is the premiere of the tour, starting November 25th, 2016 through January 1st, 2017. So it looks like it's going to run, you know, just 5 weeks or so. And then it's on to the Oriental Theater in Chicago. And then they I haven't been able to see any dates after that, but it looks like it's going to be touring around. So we'll see how it does. It's had mixed reviews in London.
Oh yeah.
So Peter, you didn't get a chance to see it when you were in London, did you?
I had a chance to see it, and I chose not to.
Okay.
Yes, I had plenty of chances to see it in London, but I made the decision not to. But I will see it here. It's easier. I mean, my time in London is precious. I want to see the things I know are going to appeal to me, or at least I suspect will appeal to me. But sure, I'll make the trip to Millburn to see The Bodyguard.
Well, it'll be interesting for me to see who they cast. I wonder if they will feel they need to get names of any sort for either of the two leads, or if they feel that just the name, the title alone will sell the show. So that's going to be really interesting.
Sure, but getting somebody to tour would be hard too.
Right, that's what I mean. So there's a whole nother level of difficulty if in trying to get a name. So we'll see.
Let's see if Hasselhoff's available. All right. So Michael and Cheetah. Michael and Peter. Cheetah, Peter. Michael and Peter got a chance to see Buried Child. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Buried Child was, I thought, an excellent production by the new group, which is a company that I thought was really struggling for several years. Now, I'm happy to say they seem to be on surer footing. They did a wonderful production of David Rabe's Sticks and Bones last year, and now they're doing Sam Shepard's Buried Child, which is a extremely disturbing play, I think, about many things. The breakdown of the American family, I suppose, is the main thrust of the plot and the theme. And this production has as the patriarch and matriarch, although, you know,
right.
To call them that is just nuts. Ed Harris and Amy Madigan. And I thought they were both excellent, but I guess I have less experience of Amy Madigan. So I just thought she was absolutely fantastic as Hallie and Ed Harris is Dodge. And they have the whole first scene, just to give you an idea of what's going on, is that Dodge is sitting on the couch in this very, you know, nondescript living room in some probably middle American small town, and he's got the TV is on, but he's not really watching it, but it remains on through the whole thing. And he's got a bottle of liquor that he's drinking, and he's smoking, and for about, I don't know, 10 minutes or more, all we hear is Hallie's voice off stage, just talking to him and asking questions and jabbering on about whatever. So right from the beginning, you get the idea that these people are not as close as they should be, and this whole separation and fragmentation of the family. The other characters, the sons, Bradley is played by Rich Sommer, Tilden by Paul Sparks. Vince, who may or may not be Tilden's son, the grandson of Hallie and Dodge, is played by Nat Wolfe. And his girlfriend, Shelley, is played by Tessa Farmiga. And the final character is Father Dewis, played by Larry Pine. And it's just one of the central things about the play is that what exactly is going on? Everything that happens, it makes you wonder what, you know, how much is true, how much is fantasy, how much are lies. One of the main things being that when Vince shows up, nobody seems to recognize him as the son or grandson. And then you think, well, does that mean he's not really there? What does that mean exactly? And you know what I thought was interesting in this production? I'd like your guys' take on it. The fellow who played Vince, Nat Wolfe, doesn't look anything like either the person who's supposed to be his father or his grandparents. And I wondered if that was done on purpose to add to our confusion as to whether he really is or not. I'd be interested to hear people's takes on that. I thought it was very well directed by Scott Elliott, and the audience really seemed to be into it for the entire hour and a half or intermissionless running time. And this, by the way, the new group is now performing at the Pershing Square Signature Center in the Diamond Stage, one of the smaller stages. I certainly don't expect to ever see a better production of Buried Child, which is a play that was considered very, very important and influential in its day. So it has great significance in that respect, if nothing else.
All right, Peter, what did you think?
Well, frankly, I did think that when Amy Madigan came in late in the play, that when we actually see her, that she did recognize the young man. So we do get the impression that he is part of that family. So,
some of the other at least two of the other characters say that they don't recognize him. I'm sorry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No,
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that no one does.
Okay, yes. So I get the impression, yes, indeed, he is part of the family. It's not like he's hallucinating. The whole point to me is the fact that this is a statement about families, that people aren't as close as they think they are to their families, that families do distance themselves from their sons, their fathers, et cetera, that we'd like to think that the family is a loving unit, but it often isn't, and we have to face that fact that this is a variation on the family. Famous statement that you can't choose your family, your relatives. You can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family, because I don't think anybody would choose this family to be a part of. One of the things that's really crazy, though, I mean, even though it's a crazy play and it deals in metaphors all the time, I don't know if indeed when Ed Harris Dodge says to his grandson, go out and get me a bottle of liquor, and leaving his girlfriend there alone is quite a thing to do, because she has to be unnerved by what's going on here. She is unnerved by what's going on here, that she has no idea who these people are, and they haven't welcomed him with open arms, and he doesn't come back that night at all. And I don't believe, as good as Tessa Farmiga is, and she's really terrific in the part, I don't know that the writing supports the fact that she would be terrified that he doesn't come back after a full night away. So, again, I may be missing a metaphor here as well that Sam Shepard wanted us to feel, but that's a long time to be with people you don't know who are weird. So so that's a problem with play. But I liked her astonishingly, and do you know the relationship to Vera by any chance? Is this a daughter? Because she mentions Vera in her bio as having been directed by her. Does anybody know what the relationship is?
I don't know.
I guess it's a sister. I mean, it would seem to be with the same last name. But anyway, under the circumstances, this is a terrific debut by this actress. And if I have objections with her reactions to being left alone for a solid night with weird people, that has much more to do with the writing or the direction than with the actress. So I hope we see more of this actress, because she really made a tremendous impression on me.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that issue, because my take on the play is that from the first moment, everything that happens is so damn weird that I don't even judge anything on the basis of
– I understand. I understand that too. Believe me, you really have to go for the ride with this one. And yeah. Again, we are talking about a play that won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yes.
And while the Pulitzer Prize, when you look back at Pulitzer Prizes, a lot of them are plays that are totally forgotten as time goes on. Here we are with a play that did eventually, in a different production from the original off-Broadway production, make it to Broadway. Not that it was a big hit, of course. A play like this could never be a big hit on Broadway. But it got there, and it ran a little bit. And here it is again. So people obviously respect it and like it and want to see it.
one of the things in it, just briefly, that I think is so disturbing is that apparently there's a situation where one of the sons, Bradley, keeps coming in and cutting his father's hair while his father is sleeping or you know, passed out drunk. Apparently this is something that's happened before. And when we see Ed Harris as Dodge in the beginning, he's wearing a you know, a baseball cap or whatever to apparently try to prevent that from happening. And then it winds up happening anyway. And we see the result of it. And that may not sound like so horrible. Oh, he cuts his hair. But when you see it, I mean, because he really cuts, he lops off his hair, and you can see like maybe bloody patches and things like that. And it's tremendously disturbing. And I guess in that case, the metaphor is probably pretty obvious.
Gotcha.
That's a visual I'm not going to be able to get out of my hair, head tonight.
It really, yeah, no, really, it really, really is.
Oh, good thing my evil children haven't figured that out yet. All right, so Barry Child is playing at the Alice Griffin on 42nd Street through April 3rd. So if you are unable to get that out of your head as well, go check it out.
Thanks. I said the wrong theater. I said Irene Diamond, didn't I?
Oh, that's okay. It, you know, you find it eventually. It's in the same building, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful space.
Yeah.
My friend Karen Valen said that this is the closest thing we have to the National Theater in London, which is a beautiful space as well. And she's got a very good point there. It really is a handsome space. I have a feeling people just go there to hang out because there's a bar, there's tables, you know, you can eat, you can drink. Of course, theater is famous for jacking up prices on anything that you buy as opposed to the convenience store around the corner. But still, it's a lovely place to sit and talk or meditate, and really it's one of the great show places in the city.
Oh, but I thought you were going to mention, I think I mentioned several times before, I find their prices distinctly lower than comparable theaters charge for various things. So all the more reason. But it's really wonderful. I had my doubts about the space when it first opened. I thought maybe it was too big, too many theaters. But they really seem to have, as the months have gone by, they really seem to have gotten into a groove. And I think it's a tremendous success. Aside from the fact that they have so much funding there, So it's really a place that should be on your map. And aside from the actual signature productions, there were these rentals that they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so disappointed that this didn't exist in my dating days because I'd always have to take people to Duane Reade. All right. So next up, Michael got a chance to see the Playhouse Creatures Theater Company's production of Tennessee Williams' 1982. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Well, this is, again, when will you ever see this again? These are two one-act plays written by Tennessee Williams about a year before he died. One of them is receiving its world premiere production, a play called A Recluse and His Guest. And the other one is receiving its New York premiere called The Remarkable Rooming House of Madame Le Monde. That second one was done at the Provincetown Tennessee Williams Theater Festival some years ago, where I've been headed every summer for the past few years. But I didn't see that one. I think it was before I started going. But this is only this is the New York premiere. The plays are extremely odd and both quite disturbing as Williams became at the end, but still fascinating. A Recluse and His Guest, if I can try to synopsize it, is about this woman named Nevrika turns up in this town. It's the setting is a far northern town in a remote time. So where we are, when we are is not clear, but she turns up wearing basically animal skins and looking for some place to stay. And the townspeople are like, what is up with this woman? Someone suggests that she may have been part of a survivor of a shipwreck. but that's never really established. Anyway, they tell her that she should go to the home of this recluse, and that maybe she can stay with him. And so she goes there and meets this guy named Ott, O-T-T, and they in fact wind up living together and have this very odd, very compelling relationship. He is a recluse. He never goes out. Eventually what happens is that Nevrika convinces him to go out to a festival that's being held, a town festival. And he's very trepidatious, but he goes with her, and they both go. He has a wonderful, wonderful time. And then as they're leaving, I think what happened is as they were leaving, a tile – like a building tile falls near him. It doesn't hit him, but it falls and it makes a very loud noise. And this freaks him out, and to the point where he says, "Oh no, no, no! Yeah, this is why I don't go out. Home is the only safe place. I'm going to stay home from now on." And so he goes back home and he throws out Nevrika, and that's A Recluse and His Guest. The second play, The Remarkable Rooming House of Madame Lamond, is set in an attic in London, and it's which is this, well, supposedly a rooming house run by Madame Lamond, but there is this fellow who is living in the attic, and his name is Mint, and he is paralyzed, or at any rate he doesn't have the use of his legs, so he gets around the room by dragging himself along on hooks that are hanging from the ceiling, and this is actually what happens in the play. The actor who did it was just extraordinary, Jade Ziani. He did that, and the physical power and dexterity that's required alone, it's breathtaking. I've never seen anything like it, and I hope everyone gets to see him in this, because it's incredible. Anyway, to make a long story short, he's basically being held captive in this attic, and it seems like we see him raped by the son of Madame Lamond, and we see that happened twice, actually. So that's happening to him. Then he finally has a visitor, and the visitor comes and winds up eating all of Mint's the food that's been left for him, and drinking all his tea while he's begging to be given some. And it's just very, very disturbing. And it's not Glass Menagerie, let's put it that way. Uh-huh. But to see, you know, it's incredible how prolific Williams was throughout his life. And even if the quality at the end is nowhere near what it was at the beginning, just to see how he changed, and dealing with different themes and just becoming less and less realistic in his writing as time went on. It's extraordinary. So I really hand it to the Playhouse Creatures Theater Company, both plays directed by Cosmin Chivu, and the other two actors, in addition to Jade Ziani, everyone was great, but the other two I'd like to mention are Kate Skinner, who played both Nevrika and Madame Lamond, and this young actor named Declan Eales, who played Madame Lamond's son as a kind of a crazed, very scary British punk rocker. He was quite quite scary when he came on and started to assault Mint. So yeah, this is being done at Walker Space, by the way, down on Walker Street. And if you can get there, you should try to do that.
All right. And also, you got a chance to get down to the Skirball Center, where you saw a production of Twelfth Night, which was a production by the Filter Theater and Royal Shakespearean Company.
Yes, this was a drastically pared-down production of Twelfth Night in every way. Not only the script itself, which I think maybe I'm going to say maybe we saw a third of the play, or maybe even less, but also no sets, no costumes, just a couple of tables on stage, a few props, two musicians in addition to the actors, a very small company. I would say that this was very reminiscent to the style of Bedlam. And to be honest, I haven't researched to see which came first. But very, very similar in a way, although I thought this was even more creative. The staging and the performance of the actors, they were in the house a lot. They were interacting with the audience, but not in an annoying way, in a very, very wonderful, creative way. And it just was so witty and creative and brilliant. The friend that I brought, who is something of a Shakespeare expert, he adored it. He was so happy that we got to see it. We didn't know what to expect, but it really was extraordinary. And let's see, it's February 16th through the 20th, so it is over. I'm sorry to say, not a long run at all. But I'm not sure how they ended up in the Skirball. There were lots of empty seats. It seemed like the kind of thing that would have been more conducive to a much smaller theater. But I guess they took what they got. I don't know what the Skirball is in NYU space. I'm not sure. You know, some kind of relationship there with the RSC or whatever, but I'm just really glad I went, and it was interesting to see it done because I have seen a few of the Bedlam shows, very similar in some ways, including the musicians on stage, but different in other ways, and just the fact that they're all British gave it that other sensibility on top of everything, but really delightful and great and wonderful production of one of my favorite Shakespeare plays.
And lastly, you got over to NJ PAC, where you saw Disney Fantasia live in concert with the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, which was conducted by our friend Ted Sperling.
Yes, which is, I guess, the theater connection. I'm not sure how Ted hooked up with this orchestra. He spoke at the beginning of the concert and mentioned that they had done it last year, I believe, and now they're doing a 17-city tour of it. And so they came to NJ PAC. But it is interesting because normally when orchestras come from other countries, they bring their own conductor. I suppose maybe it's because of the Disney connection, because it's a very American presentation in that sense. But for whatever reason, he just did a brilliant job conducting. And this was one of the most successful instances I've seen of an orchestra playing along to film. It was not the complete 1940 Fantasia. It was excerpts from that and also from Fantasia 2000. And it was, some of the most famous ones. The Sorcerer's Apprentice was absolutely in it, although that didn't come till Act Two. And it's funny, when Mickey Mouse came on, the audience applauded. And the friend I went with put up a note on Facebook saying, "I like living in a world where Mickey Mouse still gets entrance applause."
That's great.
But the orchestra sounded phenomenal, and Ted did a really great job. And and that theater is so magnificent, that large theater at NJ PAC. All the theaters there are, but that one, it's such a throwback. It's so much wood, and the acoustics are wonderful. And I'm so happy that it was built, and I'm glad it's there.
I'm at the Czech National, what was the name of it?
The Czech National
Symphony Orchestra website. And they seem to have revolving conductors here. Ennio Morricone, who's a great top film conductor and conductor in his own right in Europe, seems to do a bunch of things with them as well as other conductors. So maybe it's just that they're a band with many leaders.
Well, good for them. It was fantastic.
Absolutely. All right, before we wrap up, we're going to talk a little bit about an upcoming show on Mike Nichols that's coming up on HBO. Mike, why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, this is a really fantastic documentary called Becoming Mike Nichols. The centerpiece of it is two interviews, actually, that Jack O'Brien did with Mr. Nichols, one with an audience, one without, in a Broadway theater. And it smartly does not attempt to cover all of his Mr. Nichols' career, because if it did that, it would be completely impossible. So what they did, which was very smart, is they focused on specific things. The whole first section is about his work with Elaine May, his comedy and stand-up and television work and recording work with Elaine May, with copious clips. And it's really great to see some of that stuff again. They were so brilliant together. There's one sketch I may have mentioned before. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen, where Mike plays someone who's coming to shop. He's coming because he had heard an ad for a $65 funeral.
Yeah.
So he goes to the funeral parlor, and Elaine May is the woman who works there. And he said, "Oh yes, I'm interested in the $65 funeral." And he's very upset, and she's all kinds of businesslike and trying to, to help him out. But then he's getting ready to leave, and she says, "Well, are there any extras that you would like, to add to the basic $65 funeral?" And he says, "Well, like what?" And she says, "Well, a casket." Mm. So. They did it better than I do. Let's put it that way. But it's really funny. So there's that whole section. Then it gets into him starting to direct on Broadway and focuses on Barefoot in the Park and The Odd Couple. And then it talks about a lot about the film of Virginia Woolf and how that was such a brilliant success for him. And even if it hadn't been his first film, which it was, he says that Elizabeth Taylor was cast from the beginning, but Richard Burton was not. Mike Nichols says that was his idea, as obvious as it may seem. And so that happened. And it just really wonderful quotes from him, elicited by Jack O'Brien, who's a great interviewer and really gives a wonderful idea of this amazing man's career as a comedian, director and writer, and really just a polymath. So talented in so many areas. Lots of clips and photos, and at one point at the end, there's so much stuff that they don't get to, but they do quick montages of like playbill covers of all the shows he directed. And it's astounding how quickly they go by and some of the titles that you see come up on that screen. So it's premiering on HBO on February 22nd, but I'm sure you'll be able to catch it many times after that. And I urge everyone to see it. I had the pleasure of meeting him once or twice, and I just think he's one of the greatest talents we've ever had in the theater, and I'm sure that everyone involved with this production thinks so as well.
All right, a couple of questions, Michael, because I haven't seen this. One, is anything made of Annie?
No, I think they just mention it and show the playbill cover, if I recall.
Because he was certainly the person who was responsible for getting it to Broadway, even
right.
though he didn't direct it or write it. So the other thing, too, is isn't it amazing that a man who won a Tony Award in 1964 for direction also won a Tony Award in 2012 for direction? I mean, that is quite a span of time, to say
amazing.
The least. Yeah, and I don't think there are many careers that can really say that there were so many Tonys in that period of time. That what is that? Is that close to 50 years? It's certainly quite a lot of years. And under those circumstances, I often wonder what William Goldman thinks, because in his wonderful book, The Season, it's the one thing that we could arguably say that he got wrong, because he comes down hard on Mike Nichols and really thinks he's tremendously overrated. Now, of course, this is as of 1969. I've often wondered what William Goldman ultimately felt. Did he stick to his guns and say, "No, I'm sorry. Whatever you see in Mike Nichols, I do not." Or did he say, "I was wrong about Mike. I mean, he's proved himself time and time again." I'd love to know that.
As for me, of all the scores of things that he was been involved with over the decades. There were only two that I thought weren't brilliant. And one was the movie of The Birdcage, but that wasn't really his fault. I just didn't like the adaptation. And the other one was that Broadway production of The Country Girl, where for whatever reason, things just didn't come together. But I am glad that his last Broadway show was Death of a Salesman, because I'm glad he went out on a high like that. I thought it was just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. The thing that's crazy about this whole HBO thing is that Jack O'Brien? We need to have an HBO special on Jack O'Brien.
Well, exactly. But that's the esteem in which Mike Nichols is held, that they got Jack O'Brien to interview him, and he does such a wonderful job. Wait till you see it. There's a couple of stories. One I should tell. Barefoot in the Park was Mr. Nichols' first directorial effort, and he talks about I guess they were wherever Out of Town was, wherever it opened Out of Town, and it was right before the opening, and he said that Neil Simon literally said, "We should not open this show. This is terrible. It's not funny. We can't open this show." and Mike Nichols said, "Well, you know what? You know, we're scheduled for tomorrow for the first performance. Why don't we see what they think?" And of course, it was one of those legendary things where, for whatever reason, what had seemed not funny at all, the audience just loved it and adored it, and the rest is history.
Well, what's very interesting about that is that when Barefoot in the Park had its out-of-town tryout at the Bucks County Playhouse, it was called Nobody Loves Me.
Yes.
And and here we have, you know, by Neil Simon essentially saying that about his own play, which is kind of interesting for its own sake. And Barefoot was part of the season that I wrote about in The Great Parade, 63-64 season, and it was the first show of that season to get unanimous raves, including lines like "the funniest comedy I have ever seen." I think that was John McClane, the Journal American, who said that. But every critic, all six, went crazy for it, and it really a lot of people don't understand that because the revival that was so terrible some years ago. But it really is quite a wonderful property, and I do recommend the movie version too if you haven't seen that, because Robert Redford and Mildred Natwick reprise their roles from the Broadway show, and they're quite terrific. So it's a wonderful property. Yes, it may be of its time, and I understand that, but still there are plenty of laughs to be had.
So, Michael, next Saturday and Sunday on Staten Island, the Hemlock Theater Company is going to be doing Assassins. Are you getting over to see it?
Yes, they're only doing three performances, but I'm going to be there. It's Saturday the 27th at 8 and Sunday the 28th at
2 and 6.
2 and 6. Thank you.
Yeah.
6.
Yeah. 6.
Yeah. That's not a lot of time between shows, is it?
No.
Well, it's a short show, to be fair, too.
That's true.
Have you worked with this company? Is this how do you know them?
Well, I just, you know, from my Staten Island connection, but I haven't seen the show yet, but I saw them do a preview at this theater trivia contest that I went to a couple of weeks ago to raise money for the production. And I know that that several people in it are excellent. John Griffin, who's a wonderful actor from out there, he's in it. And you know who else is in it? Jack Dabdoub.
Jack is.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Son of the other Jack Dabdoub, who I mentioned a few weeks ago that I just found out was in one of the first two Mary Martin Peter Pans that they have released on DVD and Blu-ray. But and Jack the Elder, he just died in December 2014. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to say that his son is carrying on the tradition. So I'm definitely going to be there to see him and the rest of the cast in Assassins.
All right. And to wrap up for today, we had the passing of George Gaines. So you wanted to say a few words?
Oh, well, George Gaines just had such an interesting career, starting out as an opera singer, I believe. His actual name was – I'm not even going to try to pronounce
it. Yeah. I don't know how it's pronounced.
J-O-N-G-E-Y-A-N-S?
Yeah. when he when he was in Out of This World, the Cole Porter musical in the early 50s, he was still using that name.
But by the time he played the male lead in Wonderful Town in, what, 2 years later, he had changed it to Gaines, which was probably a good idea.
For the best, yeah.
And he's also on the he's on the studio cast album of On the Town, that wonderful the original studio cast album that Bernstein conducted with some of the original cast. And but a lot of people will know him for his role in Tootsie, opposite Dustin Hoffman. And so I just love it. I love it, love it, love it when people's careers have different acts like that.
Yep, I agree.
And he really was a stalwart and just someone who was well known to different generations of people for different properties, and I think that's really great.
All right. So before we get to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, Android device, and stream us directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at Broadway Radio, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, why don't you give us an answer to last week's trivia?
I'm going to give you plenty of answers, actually, because the question was, here's the way I asked it. This performer won a Tony for appearing in a book musical and playing a character whose name we never really know. Who is the performer, what's the role, and what's the show? Josh Israel said, well, Ben Vereen is the leading player in Pippin. I disagree with that. Other people said Michael Crawford is the Phantom, because there are other sources that say his name is Eric, but you don't hear that in the Lloyd Webber show. Kevin Kline is the Pirate King. Alan Cumming is the MC. They're all good answers, and I can't disagree with any of them. Somebody said to the engineer in Miss Saigon, but somebody else said, no, I think actually he does have a name that's mentioned once. I wasn't thinking of any of these. And again, the problem is the way I asked the question. for me, the operative word was never really know, because – the character I'm interested in assumes an identity, and we never find out his real name. He pretends to be somebody else, and for the rest of the show, he has the name of somebody else. So I'm going to let this go another week and see if anybody can come up with that name. Besides, Michael, you have a trivia question or two for us, don't you?
Yes, I do have a question, and this one may also have many answers, but so I'll phrase it this way. There are at least two cases where there are two titles of shows that have been used on Broadway. And in each case, the exact title was used for a play and for a musical. At least two that I know of. So give me those two. Or if there are others, it'd be interesting to hear what our readers, our listeners can find.
All right. So
so funny, Michael, because really my next week's trivia question was going to involve one of those two shows. It was going to be a variation on what you're talking about. So here we are in the same wavelength.
And not only that, but that trivia contest that I mentioned that I went to a couple of weeks ago as the benefit for the Hemlock Theater's Assassins. One of their questions was this role won a Tony Award for a best actor, and then years later for best actress, and so that was the leading player. So that role has been, has been coming up a lot lately. I guess
it has.
All right. So if you have an idea of what we're talking about, you can email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and let us know what you think. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sunlight, soft, soft as snow. A smile, a and a smile. Her voice, a velvet voice, sweet as music, soft, soft as snow. When she's near me,